The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning. Our first case is 14-120, State of Ohio versus Brandon Moore. For the appellant, Ms. Blumkatz.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Rachel Blumkatz for appellant Brandon Moore, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may. The United States Supreme Court's decision in Graham versus Florida requires that all juvenile non-homicide offenders be given a meaningful opportunity for release based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. It does not guarantee release for any juvenile. It could be that a juvenile never rehabilitates and demonstrates that he's fit to reenter society. But what a judge cannot do is decide that a juvenile non-homicide offender is never fit to reenter society at the outset. And he can't do that by giving a sentence that's so long that it'll ensure the juvenile dies in prison. As the Iowa, Wyoming, and California Supreme Courts have all agreed, no matter what the sentence is called, if it's called life without parole, or 100 years without parole, a sentence that denies this meaningful opportunity for release violates the Eighth Amendment.
Counsel, can we talk about a procedural issue first?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it necessary for us to reach the merits here? If we were to reverse the Court of Appeals, can we do that without reaching the merits and have them look at the merits in the first instance?
Your Honor, the Court of Appeals here decided not to grant Brandon's delayed motion for reconsideration, and it actually didn't write its own opinion in this case, so it's a little opaque what its decision was based on. It referred to some previous cases, but one of the previous cases it referred to did say that Graham was not applicable, that the Graham case wouldn't apply here, and that's why they were, at least one of the reasons why they were denying a motion for reconsideration. So I do think it's important to reach the merits of the case here in order to clarify for the Court of Appeals and lower courts that Graham is applicable in this instance.
And that's what gets us to the extraordinary circumstances, which means that they should have granted the motion.
That's correct, Your Honor. The motion for reconsideration should have been granted here because we have a retroactive decision of the United States Supreme Court. Not all of their decisions are retroactive, but this one certainly is. And that case suggests that we have a juvenile that has a sentence that is unconstitutional against the Supreme Court's categorical bar. And there's also no other way for Brandon to get that claim heard on the merits. So those together certainly meet the standard for a motion for reconsideration.
One more clarification. There seems to be a little bit of confusion about when he would actually be eligible for release. Can you clarify that?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe actually that the court here needs to draw a hard line at a particular age. And again, he doesn't need to be released, only given a meaningful opportunity to prove his rehabilitation. Because Brandon's sentence so far exceeds his life expectancy, the court here need not weigh in and draw a precise line. And indeed, the other state Supreme Courts that have addressed this issue haven't gone ahead in the first instance and drawn that line, but have left to the trial courts in the first instance to develop a record and make that determination. Those courts have focused on the primary question, which is whether Graham provides a meaningful opportunity for release for all juvenile non-homicide offenders, and that's the question this court can focus on as well.
Following up on that, if we were to agree with you procedurally, what would happen next, or what are you advocating in terms of an outcome here, and then what's the next step?
Yeah, Brandon asked that he be resentenced, and so his case would be remanded to the trial court for resentencing, and that a new sentence that he be given give a meaningful opportunity for release. Again, he's not asking that he get out tomorrow or even ever be guaranteed release, but a new sentence that he's given has to give him some sort of meaningful opportunity to prove that. And we don't have a specific procedure at issue for this court to review here. We'd be discussing that in the abstract. This case is focused on whether Brandon even receives that opportunity for a meaningful for an opportunity for release and to prove he's rehabilitated. And there's really no reason to distinguish the Graham case here and deny Brandon that opportunity. Graham rested on the fact that all juvenile non-homicide offenders have what the court called twice diminished moral culpability. That's on page 69. And that's twice diminished moral culpability because, one, they're juveniles, and two, they didn't commit homicide. And that twice diminished moral culpability means that you can't give the harshest juvenile sentence, which is life behind bars without any possibility for release. It would just violate proportionality to do that. And that applies, yes, Your Honor.
I was going to say, counsel, in this case, he was 15, had a jury trial. He was this was done as if he were an adult. He had the jury trial, was convicted of several offenses. The judge imposed sentences that were maximum sentences consecutive. So statutorily, there was no problem. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
From that perspective. And the judge did say at the time of sentencing, I'm ensuring that you will never be released again. I mean, that was the intent several times stated. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's explicit in the sentencing transcript.
So is that the problem? Because here we have statutes that the judge was following. Maximum sentences consecutively imposed are possible, assuming you go through the procedure. That is possible even for a 15-year-old if that 15-year-old was bound over.
Yes, Your Honor, we're not arguing that there's any statutory violation here. The problem is that the sentence is unconstitutional against Graham's categorical bar. And even when you have these multiple non-homicide sentences, when they amount to a life in prison behind bars sentence, they violate the Supreme Court's decision in Graham.
How much of a sentence is a violative? How do we determine the life, or how do we determine the number at which a sentence would be improper?
Well, certainly a sentence that exceeds a juvenile's life expectancy is going to deny that meaningful opportunity for release.
What is that?
Well, we actually don't have a record in this case to give precise life expectancy, and that's why this is best sent to the trial court in the first instance, just like the other state Supreme Courts have done, to look and see, well, what is a good proximate life expectancy? I'd stress, too, that the Iowa and Wyoming Supreme Courts, when they were sending these cases back to their trial courts and explaining where that line is, Your Honor, they noted that our trial courts don't need to be perfect actuarial scientists and figuring out life expectancy. Graham requires not geriatric release, they said, but a meaningful opportunity for release. You're not trying to pinpoint a juvenile.
Meaningful opportunity for release at what age? That's what I'm a little concerned with. Now, some of his co-defendants are going to be eligible in their 50s, correct? At least one?
At least one of them looks like he'll be eligible.
Eligible, but that doesn't mean he's going to be released in his 50s.
That's correct, but Graham, again, doesn't guarantee release.
Understood. So are you saying that something comparable would be appropriate here?
I would be ill-advised to give a direct number without having any record or life expectancy tables, and there's some science about how long you spend in prison and what that does for your life expectancy. Those are really good questions for a trial court.
Do you think that's something that the trial court has to take into consideration, has to conduct a hearing on?
Well, certainly our trial courts look at life expectancy in many different contexts, whether it's...
In sentencing, do they do that?
Well, I think in sentencing, trial courts are inherently thinking about how long someone will live, what an appropriate sentence will be, if it will serve rehabilitative and retributive purposes.
Purposes of a juvenile. Not for an adult necessarily.
Not for an adult necessarily, but it's part of the sentencing process. Also, when a trial court looks at a wrongful death tort lawsuit, They have to calculate and think about life expectancy there and calculating economic loss.
Okay, so there's experts that are brought in and presented testimony to the court. Is that what you're advocating here for the sentencing hearing?
There certainly can be some record developed to give a trial court judge a good sense of what life expectancy would be. I'd also stress that there are not a lot of cases that are affected here. I'm actually only aware of one other juvenile that has a sentence that's comparable to Brandon's, where he was convicted for non-homicide crimes and has a sentence that so exceeds his life expectancy like this sentence here. So I don't think
But Graham doesn't address multiple convictions.
Graham, Your Honor, doesn't draw
a single offense. Am I right?
Terrence Graham, the juvenile in that case, only received one sentence there. But the Supreme Court is very clear that the categorical bar that it's drawing doesn't make any distinction between single or multiple offenses. And actually, Terrence...
But Graham doesn't speak to the meaningful opportunity in the facts that we have here with multiple convictions consecutively sentenced, does it?
I think that Graham actually addresses it in several different ways in its reasoning. First of all, Graham's whole reasoning is based on this twice diminished moral culpability that I already mentioned, and it makes no distinction between multiple sentences. The line that the Supreme Court is drawing is between juveniles who have committed homicide and those who have not. And it's very clear about that. It says, even though crimes like robbery and rape are horrible crimes deserving of serious punishment, they still differ from homicide in both moral culpability and in consequential harm. So they're talking about homicide crimes. And Terrence Graham, if we're getting to the facts of the Graham case, he himself committed multiple crimes, and the Supreme Court knew that was part of his sentence. He committed this spree of armed robberies right before his 18th birthday.
Before your time runs out, I want to take
Your Honor.
Back to the question that Justice French introduced on the procedural irregularities here. Moore never challenged his sentence on Eighth Amendment grounds, and it became final in 2009, according to the state's position, and they argued that this new judicial ruling would not apply to a final determination that hadn't been appealed. What is your response to that position that the state says this case is over and the Seventh District never should have entertained a motion for delayed reconsideration, which really doesn't even exist in our criminal rules?
Right. Your Honor, I believe the state is mistaken in saying that Graham doesn't apply retroactively to cases that are already final. Indeed, the state never even raised this argument until the merits briefing in this case, so that argument
actually,
about—
Actually, the point would be that your client didn't raise the issue, so it's waived and it's forfeited and it's not able to be resurrected.
Well, my client didn't raise the issue before the Graham case was decided, but on the exact day that Graham was handed down, he filed a notice of appeal from his last sentencing order. So there's no delay in raising Graham as soon as it came down. I think it's very difficult to
fault. You're saying he didn't have the right of review or right of appeal based on the reasoning of Graham until Graham came down. So therefore, whether it's the Eighth Amendment argument was made or not,
he can raise it now.
The underpinnings of that argument weren't law yet.
That's correct. And I'll note in his final direct appeal, the one you're referring to, Your Honor, his counsel filed an Anders brief saying that there was no issue, and the Seventh District agreed that there was no issue. So I think it would be quite harsh to fault a pro se juvenile defendant for failing somehow on his own to anticipate.
Would it be your view that all similarly situated incarcerated juveniles have a right to a delayed reconsideration based on Graham?
I think if they raise the Graham claim promptly, certainly as Brandon did in this case, the exact same day that Graham was handed down, then they certainly have the right to
take it.
I think you'd need to take into account the individual facts and circumstances of those cases and think about why there was delay.
All of those similarly situated, in your view, would have the right to a delayed reconsideration of a final order.
I think it's hard to speculate why they if people delayed well past, you know, Graham being released. That's not our case here because Brandon was very diligent, indeed same day, bringing his Graham claim. One of the factors that courts take into account in a motion for reconsideration is the reason for delay and whether there are extraordinary circumstances that merit granting the motion anyway. But certainly,
did I hear you say earlier that there's only two defendants who are in this position?
I'm only aware of one other defendant that has a sentence that's comparable. It is an 89-year sentence and no possibility of release till he's 95. I'll note the only case that's on hold.
Do you think that's the type of case that would be reviewable under Graham?
I do think, given that a sentence so far exceeds life expectancy and denies the meaningful opportunity for release, if in the facts and circumstances of that case that client was raising his Eighth Amendment claim after Graham came out, then
okay,
that
so
would be appropriate.
Okay, so that's 95, and here we have, what, 112? Year sentence?
Yes, Your Honor.
What happens if someone is no eligibility for review until they're 80? Is that a problem?
I think it is a problem, Your Honor, because that is well beyond life expectancy of a juvenile as well. But I think, again, our trial courts are very well situated to look at life expectancy charts to see what's applicable and how to give a meaningful opportunity.
That's a whole new avenue of review for the trial court now. What you're advocating, what I hear you're advocating for is a sentencing hearing that includes life expectancy experts and maybe health experts, prison population experts, and where do you introduce that, and where do you stop? Who is entitled to have that? Only juveniles? Only individuals who's serving out an adult sentence while they were?
Certainly, this only applies to juveniles who are non-homicide offenders. Graham is very clear to draw those two lines, that this is only applying to juvenile non-homicide offenders. And again, I don't think that is a floodgates issue here where there's
so
many.
But how do we balance the fact, as Justice Lansinger pointed out, that the sentences are well within the statutory scheme and against your considerations in Graham? You think that?
I, with all respect to our legislature, even when a statutory scheme amounts to a constitutional violation, there needs to be a remedy because that's what the Supreme Court has said.
Well, I guess that's the question that keeps rolling around in my head. Excuse me. What deference are we to give to the United States Supreme Court in Graham when they indicate that the United States is the only nation that they can find that gives, I guess, poses life without parole on juvenile non-homicide offenders? I guess my question is, isn't this a legislative question that you're raising here?
Well, the Supreme Court certainly notes that, Your Honor, but the Supreme Court is very clear to make a strong holding of a categorical bar that says you can't give a juvenile non-homicide offenders any of these sentences that deny a meaningful.
But the problem is, this is the Supreme Court of Ohio, and I think as the justices have indicated, let's say we get a life expectancy of 85. You know, I'm 67, I hope that's the case. Let's go with that, okay? What guidance does that give a trial court? Okay, this kid's gonna live to be 85, you can only give him a sentence of 70 years?
Well, it may be that the legislature steps in and starts to give some of these guidelines, but even in the absence of that, this court has a responsibility to make sure that the sentences comply with the Eighth Amendment as the United States Supreme Court has interpreted the Eighth Amendment. And indeed, in other states, legislatures have stepped in. But in the absence of that, courts in Iowa and Wyoming and California and Colorado have all realized that they can't let these sentences stand because they violate Graham.
So in determining a meaningful opportunity, that's what Graham said, talked about the meaningful opportunity to be released. Have these other state courts determined an actual number in place of their legislature? Because as we know, the whole sentencing scheme in each state is a legislative matter. And right. We have statutes that determine, at age 13, for example, you have certain sexual offenses that change and so on. And here, if we're talking about a meaningful opportunity for a juvenile to be released based on multiple non-homicide offenses, shouldn't that be for the legislature to determine the number?
Well, these other state Supreme Courts, there was no statutory violation in those cases. The juveniles receive multiple aggregate sentences pursuant to the legislative scheme in those states. And still the state Supreme Court said, well, we have to follow Graham. That's what the United States Supreme Court has said is required by the Constitution. Even in some cases, they've reviewed, well, a governor tried to change some sentences to make them comply, and still the court said these sentences still exceed life expectancy, so they don't comply with Graham.
Did the court actually then determine the number?
No, Your Honor. These courts have sent the cases back to the trial court, and that's actually exactly what happened in Graham. You'll note that the Supreme Court didn't tell Florida when Terrence Graham, the juvenile in that case, actually had to be released. It sent that to Florida, and the Florida trial courts made that determination in the first instance. So Graham inherently has some of these line-drawing problems that Your Honors have been discussing, but that doesn't mean that this court can evade what the United States Supreme Court has said, and that there needs to be a meaningful opportunity for release. It's not the first time that the Supreme Court perhaps has articulated a constitutional principle and let states and trial courts take evidence, build records, and make those determinations in the first instance. And that's what this court can do here as well. But again, there's no way to meaningfully distinguish the Graham decision here, so it would be important that Brandon be resentenced and given a new sentence that does provide a meaningful opportunity for release. Thank you. I'd reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You don't have any.
Okay. But I get a minute. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Rivera.
Morning, Your Honor. Attorney Ralph Rivera on behalf of the State of Ohio and the Mahoney County Prosecutor's Office. I would like to begin by noting that there are, as the questions indicated, there are many procedural hurdles that this case offers. And as the state's amicus points out, this case might be more appropriately dismissed based on all of those procedural hurdles. One, and I think the most important question is a delayed motion for reconsideration the proper avenue for such an argument in the first place? That wasn't even raised as a proposition of law.
Well, what would be the proper avenue at this stage?
At this stage, honestly, it doesn't appear that Ohio law has an avenue.
So your view is this case can't get here?
Essentially, and that's, you kind of have to work backwards, but that's also based on the analysis that Graham absolutely does not apply to the facts of this case, which is obviously unique. Usually you start procedurally and then you get to the merits, but I think the merits of the case, as indicated in the state's brief, kind of established that procedural
hurdle. Well, let's assume for the sake of argument that we might believe a Graham analysis at least should be applied to the juvenile situation. Then does your argument that this case couldn't ever possibly get here fall apart or not?
I think there still has to be some type of determination whether, and according to their brief,
if I understand what you're saying is to get to where you are procedurally, one has to assume that Graham doesn't apply.
When you look at Graham
is that correct in your analysis of the procedural issues?
Correct. There is the rule of law where substantive, for instance, the death penalty cases, which Graham used as part of their analysis, a juvenile cannot be sentenced to death. A mentally disabled person cannot be sentenced to death. Those are clearly cases that apply retroactively to those to the offenders those type of offenders.
You're arguing Graham is distinguishable on its facts from what we have here.
Correct. Graham was clearly, he was.
Are you suggesting that there has been a final determination in this case and that this appeal had been concluded and it's res judicata? Is that your argument? That procedurally we can't hear a delayed motion for reconsideration of an order 3 years prior?
Yeah, certainly that is, that's certainly part of our argument. And that is what the 7th District based there.
If you know, normally that would be true, but there's the retroactive applicability that is articulated in the Graham decision that muddies that argument, doesn't it?
Right, and that's where I guess if we kind of skip the procedural questions for.
Well, you've got to. I mean, you've come in here and you admit that there's no avenue to get here but for the fact of a reconsideration for a delayed appeal, and you couple that with the language of Graham that makes it retroactive, and I think that leads us to deciding this on the merits.
Your argument is, though, that this wasn't a life sentence with no possibility of parole. It's factually distinguishable there, because of the multiple convictions.
And I think that's also another crucial point.
But Ms. Blumkatz argues that the analysis in Graham should apply to the facts of this case.
Correct. And procedurally
speaking. So what is your response to that argument?
Well, I guess procedurally speaking, I think there has to be a distinction between whether Graham clearly applies to Moore's sentence, or whether this is merely an extension of Graham, then obviously it would not be procedurally proper. Getting to your question regarding the rationale, if you go through their opinion, I would admit that some of their rationale does support the argument for an extension, possibly. However, Graham strictly dealt with a life sentence, and the court was clear throughout their opinion that it was dealing with a non-homicide offense.
In your view, does Mr. Moore have a meaningful opportunity for review or release in this instance or not?
Assuming Graham applies and he's entitled to that meaningful, based on the state's calculation, he will be eligible at 92. And of course, the state would advocate.
Does he get
that
a hearing before age 92?
No. I mean, pursuant to state law and the statutes that are in place at this point right now, the answer would be no.
Counsel, I thought it would be 72 of the mandatory years plus an additional 20, which would be more than 92, wouldn't it? I mean, the judicial release at 107, that's what your opposing counsel is.
And there's two. And I believe in counsel's reply brief, they agreed with the state's calculation of 92. If you look at the judicial release statute, it's my understanding that he must serve the mandatory portion, which is 72 years, and then an additional 5 years of the non-mandatory, not half of the non-mandatory. As I read the statute, it's either half of your non-mandatory term or 5 years after the mandatory portions expire.
So that brings him to 77.
That's 77, 92, correct.
And for me?
77 years prison time.
Right.
Plus the 15, so that's approximately 92 years old.
Which is the first time he'll be before the parole board.
Well, actually the court. It's a judicial release.
Oh, the court, right.
That's correct.
All right. And would you argue that that's a difference than a life sentence?
According to Graham, yes.
For the practical application, is that any different than a life sentence?
A practical application, I would agree that it's probably better than 50% chance that he will never live to see that day.
I would classify it as highly unlikely.
I would agree. And there's nothing else I could point to say otherwise. And those are the facts that we're essentially stuck with. However, I think that's why it's important that Graham dealt with one sentence and specifically a life sentence. I think the other important aspect of...
I guess I'm still having trouble trying to determine why that matters.
Why does it matter?
Why does it matter that Graham had one sentence as opposed to a series of sentences that were run consecutively, such as Mr. Moore?
He was given a life sentence plus an additional 15 for two offenses. The difference, I think, the most important difference is that the court, in its opinion, was clear that they were drawing a clear line. They were implementing a categorical restriction. A categorical restriction based on their prior case law dealing with the death penalty is that.
Who's they? Clear. What court? What are you talking about?
The Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court. The court was clear that they were drawing a clear line. A clear line is something that's easily understood, easily applied to all similarly situated offenders.
Weren't they really talking, though, about not the crime, but the time? The Supreme Court was talking about at some point a non-homicide juvenile has to be viewed by society as at least being evaluated for the possibility of release.
I think the court focused on both the crime and the time. I think they, and I think that shows in its Miller decision, where they've accepted the Supreme Court's decision in Miller, where juvenile offenders can spend the rest of their life in prison without the possibility of parole if they do commit a homicide offense.
I guess, applying the Graham analysis to this case, I guess what at least is open to argument is that the co-defendant is eligible for release at age 55, whereas the juvenile is not. Do you see an equal treatment argument that's being made?
I think that's an excellent point. The co-defendant in this case, Chaz Bunch, actually, he was sentenced to 89 years. He's not eligible for judicial release until he will be approximately 89, not 50. Chaz Bunch raised the exact same argument before the 7th District. They were denied. Chaz Bunch raised, he filed a memorandum in support of jurisdiction before this court. He was denied. He raised the exact same argument before the United States Supreme Court. They declined his cert petition.
How old was he at the time of the offense?
He was a juvenile also, I believe, around the same age, 15, 16. Off the top of my head, I don't know exactly, but around the same age. But
I didn't think we were going to be doing math today, but you are contesting what your opposing counsel said 10 minutes ago? That the co-defendant was eligible for release at 55?
Absolutely, absolutely. And Chaz Bunch, they were essentially sentenced to the exact same offenses. Both the defendants had 60 years of mandatory time for three counts of rape, three counts of complicity to rape. Chaz Bunch only had three firearm specifications as opposed to Brandon Moore because he was not involved directly in the first robbery that basically kick-started this night of
isn't that also applicable to Barnett and Evans?
Barnett and it's Barnett and Goines are two co-defendants. They are Barnett and Goines, not to be confused, they are co-defendants in a separate unrelated case. They were all four of these defendants were tried before the same court, but they are two separate unrelated crime offenses. Goines and Barnett are very different from Bunch and Moore. They had very little mandatory time, so they will be eligible around 50, 60 years. I think it's probably in their 60s. So they are very factually different from Bunch and Moore. And Barnett also, he raised the exact same arguments around the same time as Bunch. 7th District was denied in this court. And his cert petition was denied on the same day as Chaz Bunch before in the United States Supreme Court.
If we permit this procedural circumstance of a delayed motion for reconsideration to proceed, would Goines or Barnett also be eligible to file the similar motion pursuant to Graham?
It's a good question. I would say possibly not, because it would be a procedural issue. And I don't know if that.
That's what I'm suggesting, that we may have a procedural issue here. If, in fact, the 7th District Court of Appeals.
That is a procedural issue, correct. I mean, obviously, the Graham is more substantive than procedural. But absolutely, it's quite possible that they would not be eligible to raise the motion at that time, because I don't know if this court's decision. Let's say this court decides that a delayed motion for reconsideration is the proper avenue to raise such an argument in the appellate court. I don't know if Goins and Barnett and Bunch could use this case retroactively, because it would be a matter of procedure rather than.
Graham says it's retroactive.
Well, I guess I'm procedurally speaking.
Isn't the question really whether the U.S. Supreme Court has said that this judge was incorrect by stating, I do not ever want to have you released again? I mean, that's basically what this judge said for this juvenile who had not committed a homicide. So the question is, this was a sentence designed to keep the juvenile in custody for his natural life, and the question is, does Graham prohibit that under these circumstances?
The trial court sentence, I think, the trial court made that statement. It's clear. There's no denying it. I also believe that that Moore's sentence was more directly based on state law and the way the statutes are.
Right. There's no problem with the statutes as they are.
I think that's another issue, because it's almost, a defendant is almost raising an as-applied constitutional challenge. I mean, that's what it sounds like to me. And obviously, those types of challenges have to be raised at the trial court level for it to proceed.
But if the United States Supreme Court has articulated almost a substantive right to a meaningful opportunity for a juvenile to be released unless there's a homicide, I mean, isn't that what we're talking about here? The trial court saying, you have no meaningful right, you're not going to have a meaningful right, you're staying in prison for the rest of your natural life, and the U.S. Supreme Court saying, there has to be a meaningful opportunity for release.
I would just point to the fact that the United States Supreme Court was strictly and only speaking to a life sentence, a direct life sentence, not an aggregate sentence. I think this court, and as stated in the state's brief, that applying this court's analysis in Hairston, you look at each individual sentence, and if each individual sentence is less than a life term, with a possibility of release individually, every offense that Moore was convicted of, he has an opportunity for release.
But counsel, isn't it clear? I mean, I hear your position. It's an honorable position. But it seems to me the Supreme Court of the United States said states are forbidden from making a judgment at the outset, back to the timing here, that these defendants shall never be fit to reenter society. Isn't that what this trial court did? It said, you're not coming back.
And I essentially, yes. And based on the facts of this crime, I don't see how a reasonable person can find this sentence shocking in any sense.
Well, it's not a matter of shocking. The Supreme Court said you can't do it.
Right. I mean, that's if we are talking about an aggregate sentence. I would agree with
that. Well, you're saying the Supreme Court only addressed that language in a non-aggregate sentencing scheme. So the distinction you're drawing is this is an aggregate sentencing scheme, and it's a little bit different.
There's absolutely no question that the United States Supreme Court dealt with one offense and one sentence.
Right, we got that. But you said earlier that it cannot be. You said this is almost an as-applied argument, and that would have had to been raised in the trial court to have any legs at this point, correct?
I mean, that's if
well,
I'm okay, hearing
well,
part
just,
of it.
Let me just say, how could it have been raised at the trial court? Graham wasn't the law, and the retroactivity of Graham wasn't in place. So how could this be raised at that point?
Well, I mean, obviously, it couldn't at that point based on Graham. I'm strictly speaking to the argument that counsel was referring to, the mandatory time and the sentencing scheme that's in place that the trial court used, which which is obviously at this point constitutional.
Well, it was, I mean, the sentencing scheme is non-violative of the statutory scheme. The sentences that were handed out here, it does not violate the Ohio statutory scheme. I think everybody agrees with that. It's a situation of looking at the sentence through the lens of youth, and that's what the Supreme Court did, and you know, that's what we're faced with here, is seeing whether or not there really is that a distinction without a difference, to say that we've got a statutory scheme and you know, a stacking of sentencing as opposed to one single sentence that has the exact same effect.
I think it would be unfair, and I think it would be unfair that essentially a juvenile offender could essentially, as the Seventh Circuit pointed out, they could essentially create an Eighth Amendment claim based on Graham by simply committing as much crime as they possibly can. And that's essentially what happened here. If Moore would have only committed, say, half the offenses, we wouldn't be here. But he continued.
We wouldn't be here because the sentence wouldn't have been as long.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
What happens if we don't, if we deny this? Where does this case go?
If this court would either dismiss this case or deny the claim, I believe it would, I mean, it would die.
Do you think there's appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Certainly they have a yes, absolutely. There would be an appeal, possibly, to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's exactly what Chaz Bunch did, and they denied his cert petition based on
but
the exact same.
But this is much different than that.
I don't think it is. It's based on the exact same set of facts, same co-defendant, same trial, same procedural avenue. And in
when did he bring it to the Supreme Court?
The United States Supreme Court?
Yes.
This past fall.
Okay.
It was denied. And I don't have the exact
counsel,
date.
Counsel, were the other states that have dealt with this issue of Graham, have any of the courts taken the position that you have in distinguishing Graham on the basis that there was only one offense?
Yes, there's absolutely the states are a split, essentially. The Sixth Circuit, the Tenth District in this state, the Supreme Court of Georgia, Supreme Court of Louisiana, all hold agree with the state's position that you do not look at the aggregate, you look at each individual sentence. Graham dealt strictly with a life sentence for one offense.
So it's up to us to determine how broad or narrow to read Graham.
Correct, essentially.
Counsel, what's in case of this particular defendant, on each particular offense for which he was convicted, what was the maximum possible penalty for the most egregious of the offenses?
Well, he received the maximum for every single offense. I believe it was 13, so we'll say
13 years.
Yeah, he was sentenced to several first-degree felonies with firearm specifications, so that would be 10
plus 3. So it's the 10.
Yes, 10, not counting, yes.
It's the 10 plus the firearm spec added.
Correct.
So we're looking at essentially 10 years for each individual.
Yes, he got 100. There was 10 offenses. He got 10 years on each, plus 4 firearm specifications. 10 times 10, 100, plus 12 years worth of firearm specifications is 112.
And if he were to have an opportunity for a meaningful shot at getting released, that would be before the judge or before the parole board?
That would be before the judge, and that's pursuant to Ohio law at this point. Now, the legislature can come along and say every juvenile offender has to have some type of parole or release at, say, age 60 or 50 or regardless. I mean, whatever. I mean, the legislature can't do that.
But would it necessarily, so it would be back to the judge, and then the judge could say yes or no?
Correct. Correct.
At some point.
When he's eligible, yes.
When he's eligible. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute. The last point that was made by Mr. Rivera, I think, is an important one, that the legislature could intervene here without, if we decide to do, to dismiss this or deny, by saying that no matter what the aggregate or the single sentence may be for a juvenile in a non-death situation, that meaningful review must take place at X age. Could they not?
The legislature certainly could intervene and make a rule. We don't have any certainty, of course, that the legislature will act and when. And in the meantime, of course, this court has a responsibility for interpreting the Eighth Amendment in compliance with the United States Supreme Court. If I may address just a few of Mr.
Counsel,
Rivera's...
before you get to that, I'm... if we were to go down the path you're advocating, it seems to me to be a bit unfair to the trial courts to say, well, we don't know how much is too much. You figure it out. We bailed on that invitation with respect to adults when we had a case, I forget the name of it, but a judge here in Franklin County gave a couple of people like 150 years. Well, we all thought that was ridiculous. But when it came to the point of saying, well, where do you draw the line? We had great difficulty figuring that out, and we eventually bailed.
All right, well,
So give us your thoughts on how, if we take the path you're advocating, we do more than just dump it back on the trial court.
Well, first of all, the case that you're referring to, the Harrison case, is not one where there's a categorical bar by the Supreme Court preventing that sentence. So Harrison, in that line of cases, isn't applicable here.
Well, I know.
So how to give guidance?
We weren't looking at the U.S. Supreme Court. Okay. We were looking at the Constitution saying, that's a ridiculous sentence.
In terms of giving...
And that we have an obligation to do something, but we couldn't figure out what
right.
to do.
In terms of giving guidance to the trial courts here, Your Honor, I believe it's sufficient to say in this case when a juvenile sentence precludes any possibility for release, that sentence is unconstitutional and you have to give a meaningful opportunity. I do think drawing a hard line here would be ill-advised without any type of record. Certainly, you can look at what other courts have done, but indeed, those other state Supreme Courts that have sided with us have sent it back to the trial court.
Without a hard line,
yeah.
What kind of softer line? What kind of advice, some
right.
general guidelines?
So I would follow what the Iowa and Wyoming Supreme Courts gave their trial courts as guidance. And they said that you weren't looking for, quote, geriatric release. These are quotes in our briefing. And the trial courts didn't have to be perfect actuaries getting into the niceties of epidemiology, as they pointed. But they're looking at general life expectancy, not geriatric release, such that a juvenile has a meaningful opportunity to reenter society. So they were instructing the trial courts, you know, you don't have to be perfect scientists here, but you're not looking for geriatric release. You're looking for a meaningful opportunity.
But you are asking for a categorical, this is an Eighth Amendment violation, no matter how many crimes a juvenile might commit. Does that make sense? Is there any point at which a juvenile could commit horrendous non-homicidal crimes, and they're stacked up further than we have in this case? Is there ever a point where that wouldn't violate the Eighth Amendment to sentence?
No, Your Honor. And actually, the Supreme Court addresses this very explicitly in the Graham case, When the Supreme Court's deciding whether to draw a categorical rule for all juvenile non-homicide offenders or let it go on this case-by-case basis, and maybe there's a case that's so horrendous, the Supreme Court explicitly says no, it's going to draw a categorical line. And this is pages 78 to 79 of the opinion. The Supreme Court says that it doesn't want the heinous nature or the cold-blooded or brutal nature of a crime to overwhelm mitigating circumstances based on youth. And therefore, it says its categorical rule, quote, gives all juvenile non-homicide offenders a chance to demonstrate maturity and reform. That's page 79. I'd also note Chief Justice Roberts' concurrence in this case makes sort of that point as well. He notes that even in heinous non-homicide cases, the grand majority decision gives a juvenile a chance to prove him or herself. And Chief Justice Roberts actually gives the example of a gang rape. So there's certainly acknowledgement that irrespective of the facts, all juvenile non-homicide offenders but are going to receive this opportunity.
And it's not the idea that they're going to be released. It's the idea that there's the opportunity for a meaningful hearing.
Graham is very clear about that, Your Honor.
But counsel, isn't the reality the United States Supreme Court was also legislating when they used the term non-homicidal? Because if they're saying that all juveniles should have the opportunity to demonstrate, say at their 40th birthday, they're rehabilitated, unless you killed someone.
Well, the Supreme Court is, I don't think they're legislating. They're trying to protect the proportionality that is embedded in the Eighth Amendment.
But counsel, if the rationale here for holding or for extending Graham, the protection of Graham to juveniles, is for is based on their lack of maturity, the lack of brain development, all the plethora of things that are now demonstrated with some authority and credibility about the juvenile brain and its development and impulse control and the appreciation for right for wrong, etc. Why doesn't that apply to death?
Why doesn't that apply to if they commit
if
homicide?
If this young lady had died as a result of this horrific gang rape.
Well, the Supreme Court actually addresses that question in the Miller case, Your Honor. And it says in the case of when a juvenile commits homicide, it's because homicide is a worse crime than even aggregate non-homicide crimes.
But let me just draw a parallel here. For an adult defendant who is disabled, has a mental deficiency, there is a consideration even when it's a brutal death crime. Is there not?
Yes, there's no death penalty.
And that's based on scientific evidence and culpability and appreciation and all the rationale that goes into making that decision, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
What's the difference?
Well, I certainly don't think that this court needs to go that far in this case. We only have non-homicide crimes here. I think the best way actually to answer your question, Your Honor, is to look at that analogy with the death penalty that you're talking about. Because the Supreme Court in Graham and later in the Miller case does exactly that. They analogize the death penalty for adults to juveniles facing life in prison without any possibility for release. And they're using the same jurisprudence in both instances. So we know the death penalty for adults can't be given to adults no matter how many non-homicide crimes they commit. And this goes back to Justice French's question. They could commit a whole series of robberies and rapes and all of these things. They still can't get the death penalty. The Supreme Court is reserving the most severe punishment for homicide. And they do the exact same thing for juveniles. Very explicitly, they actually cite all of those death penalty cases in Graham. And they say it's the same thing. That top punishment for juveniles, life behind bars without any possibility for release, we're reserving that for the worst.
But that doesn't make any sentence to me. If a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old, same neighborhood, same life experiences, same brain development, et cetera,
well, that may militate going even farther, but again, that's not what we have here, so you don't have to go that far. But But certainly all of those factors that you're mentioning are part of the Supreme Court's reasoning in Graham is why you can't lock the prison cell door and just throw away the key forever.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.